Good morning. This is Dawn Ely, and you are with Corporate Conversations on Atlanta Business Radio. And we're here with our producer, Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Dawn. How are you doing today?
Fantastic. It's a beautiful day in Atlanta, so it's we're looking to get out of the studio as soon as possible. But we've got such a great show here today. It's one of my personal favorites. It's on healthcare and healthcare costs and the premiums that employers are facing. Our healthcare costs really break in your corporate bank. And I'm really excited about this because this is my personal background. And with us today, we have Chris Clark, VP of McCart Employer Services, and John Myers, partner at Seyfarth Shaw Law Firm, and Terry Foreman, founder and managing director of Impact Corporate Health Solutions. So we're really pleased to have all three of you join us today. And Lee, who is our show sponsored by today?
Today's show is brought to us by Palladium Chief Legal Officers, CLOs, offers highly experienced divisional and general counsels as your in-house CLO at budgetable flat-rate fees on a part-time or interim basis. Your company gains the assistance of a dedicated CLO without the cost of having an expensive full-time executive legal employee. Palladium CLO brings to your business in-depth knowledge of your industry, of the players in your industry, their business, and how the various legal and business issues affect your industry and your business. Palladium sees the possibilities, not just the liabilities. You can find out more at www.palladiumclos.com.
Fantastic. You know, everybody has been inundated with healthcare issues, healthcare new legislation, healthcare costs, and now we're getting into the time of the year when many employers are actually seeking around and renewing their health plans. And it's every year, it has been such an expense for most employers, especially the small to mid-size companies. And now the 2011, it's estimated that Medicare, who is the largest payer to the healthcare industry, is not going to increase payments to the hospitals and healthcare providers for the first time in 7 years. So what does that mean? Well, that cost shifting gets going over to the private insurers and therefore the employers. So that could mean some even more increased expenses next year and even this year as you are renewing your plans. So we're finding that employers are actually implementing a lot of different types of ways to control costs beyond just shopping around to find the lowest premium. I think 67%, they say, in 2011 are planning to expand or improve wellness programs. 40% are intending to increase employee contributions, and another 40% are intending to increase the cost sharing of deductibles and copays, and 26% increasing prescription. We've seen and have heard in the media some extreme examples of trying to control costs of employees banning smokers. There was a Wyco company in Michigan who did that, and Timberland recently came out and said no more smoking. And it really doesn't care about the, you know, personal behaviors, et cetera, et cetera. It's costing employers money. So what we're going to do is today talk about real issues that we can pass along to the employers who have the small to mid-sized companies that they do have options available that can really work. So, Chris, I'd like to start with you. Chris Clark, he is a VP of McCart's Employer Services Division, and he has 20 years of experience in employee benefits consulting. Chris began his career in 1985 with Milliman, an international actuarial consulting firm, and throughout the 90s he worked for Aon, the second largest international insurance brokerage and risk management consulting firm. And before coming to McCart, Chris worked for Palmer & Kay, a regional insurance brokerage firm based in Savannah. Chris earned his BBA in actuarial science and an MS in risk management from Georgia State University. And Chris has been practicing in this area for many years, including being an adjunct professor at Georgia State in the risk management and insurance department. So, Chris, tell us a little bit about what you're seeing in today's market with employers. Are they just beyond frustration and trying to find different ways of controlling costs? And what are you able to offer them beyond just simply shopping around for lower premiums?
Yeah, they really are, Dawn. They, you know, most of our clients really want to provide the best benefits that they can afford for their employees. And as the cost has gone up in double-digit rates in many cases over several years, they've gotten to the point where they've got to come up with a better way of controlling those costs. And the way that many of our clients are turning to is wellness. And wellness is basically trying to keep the folks in your population that are relatively healthy today, having them continue to be healthy. And by doing that, they try to manage certain behaviors in their population, such as inappropriate eating, lack of exercise, use of tobacco. And if they can manage those behaviors early, they won't develop into chronic conditions down the road and be very costly to the health plan.
Chris, what are you seeing employers wanting to do in terms of employees that are already unhealthy? They already have a smoking habit or a, an obesity problem or some other that's a lifestyle issue. Are you seeing employers being able to relate increased costs to these unhealthy personal habit type employees?
There are studies out there that indicate that, for example, an obese person averages $1,000 to $2,000 a year in extra health care costs, and someone who uses tobacco on average uses about 10% more health care than someone who doesn't use tobacco.
That's crazy. I had heard some statistic that a smoker costs the healthcare industry in excess of $90 billion a year. Of course, that's a national statistic. But do you have any ability to tie what it costs for a smoker employee versus a non-smoker employee of the same demographics to an employer?
Well, again, it's about 10% extra in healthcare. So, if the average single premium today might be around $400 a month, a smoker would be about $40 a month more in expected cost.
So that's just not healthcare costs. That's actual premium costs.
It's healthcare costs that ultimately is translated into premium.
Right.
What about productivity?
Well, obviously, we're all familiar with folks taking a smoking break, et cetera. But in addition to that, that loss of productivity, you also have, anytime you're out of work and needing to see the doctor, that's clearly a productivity loss for the employer.
What kind of examples are you seeing employers either trying to put together or being offered to by the health and plans or the wellness plans out there? What are people looking at and what's available?
It runs the gamut. There is a whole lot of wellness programs out there. Almost every employer has some type of wellness program going on. The most basic type programs have been around for a long time and might include things like health fairs at work, Weight Watchers. Those typically have very low incentive to participate. Maybe we'll subsidize your cost in this program. There's the way we look at it, there's kind of a middle stage where we're trying to move most of our clients to today, where it's a lot more comprehensive, where it looks at, instead of targeting a single issue like smoking or weight, it sort of looks at all issues related to good health and tries to tie those together into a program with participation-based incentives around being involved in those programs. And our employers that are really kind of pushing the envelope today go into what you might call a cutting-edge approach, much more comprehensive, larger success-based incentives, meaning that we'll actually take a measurement of your health this year, and then next year we'll take another measurement, and you need to have either maintained good health or improved your health status to get the incentive for the new year.
And what kind of incentives are those? Are they like increased employer premium contributions, or what kind of incentives are they?
Well, again, when you move into some of these higher, more comprehensive programs, the incentives tend to get bigger because you're really trying to drive participation. And there's a lot of studies out there about how much incentive tends to get someone to act. And usually it has to be well over $100 before you start seeing people take action towards what you want them to do. There's some legal rules around, and I think John may get into that a little bit, but there's some legal rules around how much incentives you can do and how to provide those incentives to make sure that you don't run afoul of tax law or other law.
Mm-hmm. Or discrimination or something like that. I know John's going to tell us where our boundaries are later. Are you seeing that these wellness programs have an impact for cost savings on these employers? Are there statistics that are tying those two together, and is it worth it for the employers to go through that process?
There are a lot of studies out there. You really have to have a very large group to do an actual ROI study on that group, just because it's so hard to say, what would you have cost me had you not made this change? It's very difficult to know on an individual basis what their healthcare difference might have been. But when you have large groups that have gone through some of these programs, and there's been some very detailed studies around those, especially possibly using a control population as part of that group, the studies have tended to see in the area of 3-to-1 ROI long term.
When you're saying large, how are you defining large?
I would say 5,000+ type folks. But again, that doesn't mean that that it's not valuable for the smaller employer. It just means that to actually try to get an ROI calculation for you, you kind of have to read the material, understand it, or have someone consulting with you that can explain it. And then you buy in to that concept based on how it might have worked with a larger group, and then feel comfortable in rolling that out in the expense you have to go to for your smaller group.
So that's sort of like an actuarial, statistically significant kind of ROI, as opposed to just measuring cost of this year versus last year.
Right, because as we've seen, healthcare trends, if you do nothing, tend to go up these days in the neighborhood of 10%. So if I only go up 5%, does that mean I won or did I lose because I still went up? Mm-hmm. So you have to understand that the costs are going up at a close to 10% rate in the absence of doing something, and then enjoy the benefits coming off of that.
I know some employers are experiencing 20 to 30 to even 50% increase in their premiums year over year, and that may be for a small employer who does not have necessarily the numbers to spread across more healthier employees if they have one or two key unhealthy employees, which that can be pretty significant. So do you see these programs then? You say that they can work for a small to mid-sized company. I know we're going to talk with Terry, who implemented a very successful one with only a 200 to 300 employee base. What are some of the success stories that you have experienced so far with what you do with your clients?
Well, in some cases, we're actually able to negotiate a slightly better rate with the insurance carrier in exchange for the employer adopting a comprehensive wellness program. Now, in those cases, you may be looking at 1.5% to 2.5% reduction in next year's premium, for example. Now, that may not sound like much, but again, when you're talking about that compounding over many years and potentially improving a little as you move forward, it can add up to a tremendous amount. Some of the success stories that we've seen in our client base, a lot of it has to do with employees feeling better about themselves and answering some surveys where they say they feel like they're being more productive now that they've changed their behavior in terms of how they eat, eating healthier, exercising more, and getting away from use of tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
We've also seen what you might call a trickle-down effect a little bit. A lot of our clients will ask, well, how do we roll this out to spouses and children of our employees? Because a lot of our healthcare costs come from those groups. And it's very difficult to include them in a worksite wellness strategy. But what we found is that as the employee goes home and wants to make different choices around what's for dinner, different choices around what activities the family might be doing on the weekend, et cetera, we've actually heard them report back that they've actually seen changes in their family's behaviors as well.
Interesting. What kind of percentage, or is there a known percentage of unhealthy behavior people that access the healthcare system and then increase the healthcare costs, that those behaviors that produce that need really could have been modified?
Well, the studies indicate that somewhere between 50% and 70% of our healthcare expenditures in this country are due to preventable conditions.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, conditions that may have never occurred had the person had more healthy behaviors earlier in their lifetime.
Yeah, a la child diabetes, which is
exactly
nuts that we have that.
Is there any research on how these kind of programs affect the turnover of employees? like to, if these programs are in place, especially if they are integrated with their entire family, does that improve the people staying there longer at a job?
I'm not aware of any. I'm sure that there are, but the, you know, to kind of expand that concept a little bit, I think any time when an employee feels like the employer has their interest at heart, it's an incentive for them to stay around. Mm-hmm. And that would be one of these type programs, especially if it's rolled out properly.
Are you seeing any employers wanting to be more aggressive in offering both a carrot and maybe even a stick to participate in these wellness programs if they are not healthy, if they are obese, or if they're a smoker, such as, you know, modifying their premium contribution if they do or don't participate, or anything that is rather dramatic, like what we saw in Michigan with Wyco or even with Timberland, that, you know, just did this complete ban on smoking for their employees?
Yes, definitely yes. I mean, again, as we were talking about at the very beginning, a lot of employers have kind of reached the end of their rope in terms of what they can afford to spend, and also to a certain extent how much they can afford to continue to shift to employees as costs go up. And so there's really an expectation for many of our clients now that the employees really have to take a much bigger stake in this process in terms of staying healthy. And you read in news reports about the more extreme cases and some of the ones where they're, you know, they'll say, we're not hiring smokers, or you can't work here anymore if you smoke. But we're, you know, in our general client population, we may have a few that want to ask about those, but not so many that are willing to really go quite that far. Mm-hmm. However, they, you know, it is starting to become common to have these programs where you have to initiate into the program before you can even sign up for your health care benefits for the new year.
Interesting. So you don't get health benefits at all unless you sign up for the wellness program.
That's what some of our clients are starting to do.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm looking forward to when we get to John's segment on some of the legalities of what you can and cannot do. And, you know, for example, if you decide you're not going to hire smokers anymore, you know, can you start asking in interviews, you know, do you smoke? You know, what's your BMI? That's an interesting topic, because I know that an article I read about the Wyco situation in Michigan, where they did ban all smoking from all their employees, whether they were smoking during work hours or on Saturday afternoons. And this article mentioned that Georgia's laws were very similar to Michigan in that those kinds of discriminations based on state law are permissible. So if we wanted to, we could start having every Georgia employer stop hiring and firing employees who are smoking. Now, of course, that's contingent upon what John says we can and cannot do, both with state and federal law issues and with this new health care reform. But I find that very interesting that employers now have options to help control their costs through, on some level, controlling their employees' health. And I think that's a great option. And, you know, is that an incentive? Is that why your employer customers are doing this? Or is it really about costs, or are they more altruistic and just wanting a good employee base? Or are they looking at productivity, as Lee had mentioned? What's their motivation for implementing these?
It's definitely a mixture of all of those. I mean, I think what drives it tends to be cost. But as they look into potential programs, they see the potential for productivity increase, and when we roll it out, the communication campaign tends to be more about how can we help the employee become better, mm-hmm. feel better, you know, feel better about themselves, feel better, you know, in just their general life, and be more productive, not only at work, but in their personal lives.
Do these wellness programs cost an employer any money to implement and to run?
They do have a cost associated with them. They tend to be relatively modest, in the range of say 2% of premium is kind of a good benchmark if you want to think that. Another number that you might want to keep in mind, probably somewhere around $100 per employee per year.
Per year, $100 per employee per year. And so that's, you know, 1-2% of premiums in order to save, you know, what you were saying, what, another 2% or so on the premiums year over year?
Right. It should pretty balance out pretty quickly in terms of cost as you potentially save in premium. I mentioned before that we've had some success in negotiating with some of the health carriers out there to get a reduced rate in exchange for a comprehensive program mm-hmm. being rolled out for a particular employer.
Yeah, especially when you look at the statistics that 50% or more of healthcare costs are due to preventable conditions in the patient. So if employees or employers' premiums don't go up at all, you know, with the balance between the extra cost for the wellness, but yet the cost savings from the healthcare cost savings, that's a boon right there. Everybody would love to see their premiums stay static year over year. So that's not a bad story. Does anybody have any questions for Chris? Okay. Well, great. Well, Chris, tell us a little bit more about McCart and your target customers and what you do for them and how we can reach you.
Well, the McCart Group has been around since 1971. We have about 100 employees. We help our clients with all areas of their business insurance needs, as well as some ancillary related services that we provide. We have a benefit administration and payroll administration outsourcing unit. We also have a safety and loss control unit that helps clients avoid potential problems, you know, that might be insurance issues down the road. Our clients range anywhere from 50 lives up to 30,000 lives. Our target, our primary clients tend to fall in the 100 life group up to a few thousand lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we help them, again, with all areas of insurance, employee benefits, group insurance-related issues, as well as their business insurance, property casualty, workers' comp, liability insurances.
Okay, great. And how do we get in touch with you to help us out with our insurance needs?
My email address is chris.clark@mccart.com, and my direct phone at work is 678-205-1511. And the McCart Group is located in Duluth, in a northeast suburb of the Atlanta area.
And your company website is?
It's www.mccart, which is mccart.com.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chris, for that wealth of information. It's really good to know what's out there and what people are leaning towards. I'd now like to move to Terry Foreman. Terry is the current founder and managing director of Impact Corporate Health Solutions, a consulting company that focuses on the small to medium-sized business throughout the U.S. to help them implement proven strategies to reduce and stabilize healthcare costs. Terry was previously the manager of corporate benefits of TI Automotive that had a plant here in Cartersville, Georgia. And in her role there, she developed and implemented what became a nationally recognized health improvement program that actually resulted in an average 20% reduction in healthcare costs. And this is for a 200 to 300 employee-based population. So this is right for our small to medium-sized groups that can now learn from Terry how they can implement something that can be successful in that small of a medium-sized company. Ms. Foreman is also recognized for her support and guidance to senior executive staff on achieving change during difficult economic times, which we could all use right now. She is a member of the Health Focus Group of the Automotive Industry Action Group and has been a popular invited speaker at numerous association and business group conferences across the country. Her primary focus is on applying proven business practices to health strategies that can achieve bottom-line impact. And, Terry, that's just what our show is about here today. How can we apply these practices to health strategies that can achieve bottom-line impact? So, Terry, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you. It is a pleasure to talk with all of you today.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what was going on in TI Automotive that prompted you to wanting to implement something new beyond the usual small to mid-sized employer of just shopping around for better premiums? What was happening?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, you may have recalled this was back in 2004 when this started, and at that time the auto industry was really starting to feel a great deal of pain and having some issues regarding the economic conditions that we were facing. So one of the largest costs associated with that was healthcare. And while TI is a global supplier to the auto industry, we do have a location in Cartersville, Georgia, where all of this really kind of started. And they have around 200 employees, and I think they can be related to as a small to medium-sized business even though they are part of a larger entity. But primarily, we were struggling and really desperate to find a solution to control the cost. Much like the rest of the country, we were looking at increases around 12 to 13% every year, year after year. And if we tracked that out at the time, by the time we got out to, 10 years down the road, we'd be looking at spending about $25,000 per employee per year.
Wow.
Now, we happen to be self-insured. However, whether you're self-funded or fully insured, $25,000 a year is not sustainable.
Yeah.
You'd stop offering benefits before you got to that point, or you'd be out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So it truly was a tipping point, as they say, and something needed to be done. In our industry, we're pretty famous for root cause analysis and data-driven solutions and that type of thing. So the first thing we needed to look at to decide which direction to go in was the claims data that we had access to. And what we found was that the majority of our claims were being driven by chronic conditions, things like diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, obesity. Not surprising, it's the same thing the rest of the country is experiencing. So, I mean, this wasn't rocket science per se, but it did tell us where we should be targeting our efforts. We didn't have a heck of a lot of money to spend, so we needed to be very, very focused as far as what we were looking for. So the bad news was we knew what the conditions were. The good news, if you will, was that we know that those chronic conditions can be reduced or virtually eliminated by what you eat, how much you move, whether or not you smoke. Three things that can be impacted by the decisions people make every day. So with that, the story continues. We also knew that in Cartersville, when we started this out, they were one of the highest cost facilities that we had, and contemplation was being made to actually move the business to China. So they had a vested interest in making this work and making it work pretty quickly. We knew that the best thing we could do is find the people at risk that had not experienced an event. The only way to do that would be to get them to participate and be screened, and I'll go through in a minute what the screen consisted of, but we needed to get them engaged in the activity. We were looking for people that never go to the doctor, that wait for that huge event to come down the way before they ever get treated. So to do that, we created two medical plans during open enrollment of that year. We had a base plan, and this is pretty simple insurance stuff, 80-20 coverage with a $1,000 deductible. Then we created a premium plan, which again was 80-20 coverage, $250 deductible. So there's only a $750 deductible difference in the two plans. However, the incentive, we call it a carrot or a stick, if you elected the premium plan, you had to participate in the screening. If your spouse was covered, your spouse had to participate in the screening. And if you were found to be at a high level of risk for chronic disease, you had to enroll in a risk reduction program. We weren't exactly sure what the reaction would be to that, but as it was rolled out, we had 98% of the population pick the premium plan.
The $250 premium.
Got what we wanted.
Right.
We knew if we could get them in the door, then we could do something with them. So we did the screening, and in Cartersville, it was a little over 300 by the time we did employees and spouses. Of that population, we found 32 people to be at significant risk for chronic disease. Now, the screening included things like their lipid panel for their good and bad cholesterol, triglycerides. We did glucose, blood pressure, BMI measurement, and then for men over 40, kind of a bonus, if you will, we did TSA because it could be done using the same sample. And we all know that if you can identify and catch prostate cancer very quickly, it can be treated and eliminated if you can catch it in its early stages. And again, we knew a lot of these folks had never been to the doctor. So that was something else that we added in there that really wasn't part of the chronic disease thing, but we thought it was important nonetheless. Now, the screening itself, and I always like to say, I know there's lots of companies out there that sponsor health fairs, and they're terrific, and they're at the work site, and they've got lots of positive energy and free stuff, and they're terrific. The screening we put our folks through was not a health fair.
Mm-hmm.
This is a production facility. it was going to be done during company time. This is automotive. We were at a very critical point in our lives. We had to get people in, get them screened, and get them back on the floor as quickly as possible. So that became quite the production of itself. We had them complete a very limited health risk assessment. There was only about 8 or 10 questions. You know, things like, do you smoke? Do you know what your numbers are? Are you currently on any medication? What's your family history? Those types of things. We didn't ask the seatbelt question, the are you safe on a ladder, all that kind of stuff. That's important, but we didn't ask it at that time because, again, this was pretty focused. They then went through the screening and then got back to work. Once the results came in, then we were able to identify 35 people that were at a high level of risk. So you can see, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, it's the 80-20 rule. There were 20% of your employees incur 80% of your cost.
Mm-hmm.
The same was true in this type of a scenario. We enrolled those people in an 8-week risk reduction class. Key to the success of the class, in my humble opinion, on-site during company time. They didn't have to take time out from doing kids' activities or any of their personal time. We did this. We paid for them to attend the class. We also brought in a licensed and registered dietitian to teach the classes. There are lots of good health coaches, lots of good health educators out there, very well-meaning, well-intentioned. We wanted the experts, and you're going to find that with a dietitian who can really work with individuals on making changes and having impact on their lifestyles. The dietitian taught things that could be used in daily life. What's the difference between a good fat and a bad fat? How do you read a food label? When you go out to eat, what are your best choices? You know, those types of things that really a lot of people, including myself, didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
It can really make a big difference. At the end of 8 weeks, we screened the folks again. We asked them during that 8 weeks, give this your very best shot. Consider yourself your very own experiment. How much can you reduce your risk? And once you know that, are you willing to do what it takes to continue?
Mm-hmm.
So this program was pretty aggressive.
Yeah, very intensive.
And it's, you know, face-to-face, sitting in a classroom kind of thing. It's not the phone consultation where it's easy to sit on the phone and eat Oreos while you're talking to your health coach. This is right there. So at the end of 8 weeks, we did the screening again. And of those 35 folks, there were only 4 people left at high risk.
Hmm.
So that was our, you know, drum roll, aha kind of moment. 13 of those 35 had taken their total cholesterol to ideal levels of less than 200 in 8 weeks.
Wow, that's fabulous.
And the blood pressure tanked, glucose levels went down. The thing they got the most excited about was that the average weight loss of the group was 13 pounds in 8 weeks. So that was kind of those, again, little bonus byproducts.
We also
looked at the culture at Cartersville and said, okay, it's going to be important that you walk the talk. So things were done in order to ensure these people had the greatest level of success, like changing your vending options. That doesn't mean you're going to eliminate the M&Ms, but what it does mean is that you're going to put some healthy alternatives in the vending machines so that the people that are at risk can be successful. I mean, there's nothing worse than being told you have high cholesterol and then look at a vending machine that's got nothing in there you can eat.
Mm-hmm.
So we did those types of things. Putting in a water machine. Water was 10 cents, pops a buck 50. Which one you got to pick?
Mm-hmm.
Those types of things. We actually established a nutrition policy similar to a safety policy and attendance policy that said we want our folks to be as healthy as they can be. And by doing that, it means move more, don't smoke, watch what you eat, that type of thing. We banned smoking. You couldn't smoke on the premises, couldn't smoke in your car. We didn't care what you did at home necessarily. We didn't go to that degree. But if you were at work, unless you left the building and went across the street or down the road, you wouldn't be able to smoke. As a result, we had a number of people quit just because it became too difficult, and it was like, okay, well, this pushed me to where I wanted to be anyway. So once we had the numbers from the Cartersville facility, we had 22 locations throughout the country, and we rolled it out to those locations as well. Different cultures, different leadership, different, you know, lots of different folks. Some were primarily female locations, others were primarily male. We used the same benefit model where they got a lower deductible if they chose to go through the screenings. And each and every location at the end of the week had significant results. Now, Cartersville always led the charge. They really were our flagship in many, many ways. But in 2005, we screened 3,500 employees. We found 330 people at high risk. We also found about 14 people with prostate cancer in its early stages, so that was a whole lot of cost that we were able to eliminate by getting those folks in and into the medical community and get those folks treated. At the end of the 8-week program, we went from 330 people at risk to 52. Hmm. It didn't matter if they were union or non-union, it just went across the board. Again, not all were as successful as others, but each and every one of them improved. So that basically tells us that all you have to do is get the information to the people. The people do the work. They really do want to be as healthy as they can be. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not going to have folks sitting in the back of their classrooms with their arms crossed and you're not going to tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite thing to tell them is you are absolutely right. You have a God-given right to die of heart disease if that's what you want to do. And I'm not here to stop you from doing that. But the majority of the people appreciate and really enjoy having the opportunity to learn things that were not as hard as they thought they might be.
Terry, were you able
to...
As
Winston Churchill says, no matter how beautiful the strategy, you should occasionally look at the result. The dollars came into being from the finance group and said, this is terrific, but show me the money.
Mm-hmm.
In Cartersville, between 2004 and 2007, their health care costs decreased by 34%.
In 3 years.
That's not decreasing the increase. That's starting at point A and reducing point A by 34%. Corporate-wide was a little bit different because you don't, I mean, we have primarily the union groups where you have the contract negotiations. You can't just, you know, go in and make it what you want. But by the same token, our goal was, let's just keep it to the rate of inflation. If we can just stop these continual 10, 12, 15% increases, you know, what will that do to us? We know we can sustain where we are today. It's just where we are tomorrow that we're not going to be able to handle. So over a 3-year period, the same 3 years, we were able to keep our cost at 2% increase year over year corporate wide. Again, about 3,500 employees. So with that, we were extremely pleased, and that's without any plan design changes. That's without any payroll deduction increases. As a benefits manager, open enrollment became a non-event. You could just stand up in front of people and say, guess what? No copay change, no deductible change, no payroll deduction increase. Life goes on, and we continue to improve the health of the population. That's the story. You know, it's something that can be done, and since I have left TI, I champion this cause with many small and medium-sized employers to tell them it's not as overwhelming as you think it might be, and people will do the right thing given the opportunity and the education.
Terry, did you see any improvement in those people who were already experiencing problems and already going to the providers in going through this wellness program?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we had one gentleman in particular who was probably one of the greatest champions. The guy was, I think, 42 at the time and had had 5 cardiac events.
Oh, my.
And just, and you can imagine how he felt.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, when's my number up? And he was in risk reduction classes for 2 years. In each time around, he was found to be continuing at high risk. But by the 3rd year, he'd come off of the majority of his meds. he became the guy that, that was the cheerleader for everybody else that says you can do this.
So despite
he's been debt free since,
mm-hmm.
and it's just one of those great success stories that warms your heart.
Wonderful. So even with those who have known risks already, as opposed to hidden risks that you find out through the health screening, you're still able to save 34% in healthcare costs and keep mm-hmm. your premium increases to only 2% a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's only in a 200 to 300 population base.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty significant for that size of population. What do you
well, and the other thing that, you know, as the years go on and you have an opportunity to focus on other things, if you take your folks, for example, that are on lipid-lowering drugs, the cholesterol meds, the, you know, Plavix, the Zocors, those types of things, those are terrific. But more and more evidence is coming forward that's saying unless you make those changes along with it, these aren't going to prevent you from having an event.
Mm-hmm.
So the next step in my mind is to identify those folks and bring them in and say, look, this isn't a magic pill. You know, you can't do this and then eat whatever you want or stop moving.
Mm-hmm.
It's in conjunction with, and there's been many folks that have come off meds completely.
Wow.
Because they've learned how to do the right thing.
And that's part of your healthcare cost savings, right? Because now there's no more prescription costs as
you
much.
Betcha.
Yeah, absolutely.
You betcha.
What about the people who stayed at the $1,000 deductible plan? Did they just simply not want to participate and that was just it and, you know, there's nothing you can do with those people? They just paid a higher premium.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
You're never going to get them all.
Yeah, so that's the stick. You know, you pay or play.
Yep.
Did you find, you know, you mentioned that this was more successful in certain areas than in others. Did you notice a difference that you could identify, whether it was management leadership, whether it was just location and culture of the location being the South versus the North or any of those kinds of factors that you could tie success to?
I think it was a little bit of all of the above. Certainly the leadership plays into it. Now, from the very top, and again, this is a global corporation. It's a big company. And they had lots and lots of things going on in their life at the time. Healthcare costs was just one piece of what was happening. So there wasn't the big giant cheerleaders at the top, although certainly we had support. It wasn't the, you know, get out there and testimonial and cheer them on because, again, there was lots of things going on and this was just one small piece of it. But at each location, I think the plant manager and the tone that was set by them probably made a pretty significant difference.
Mm-hmm.
The union facilities versus the non-union, again, you couldn't have the same incentive structure. So the union facilities was more of a voluntary type of program. And voluntary is okay, and I know lots of companies do that, especially when they're first starting out. The problem I have with voluntary is that those are usually the folks that are going to do good stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm. So you feel like you needed that stick of that alternative plan of the $1,000 deductible to really motivate people to participate?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very interesting. So you found that, you know, just because you're not a 3,000 employee-based employer, you can have some significant cost savings in just a 200 to 300 population by implementing a really intensive, great wellness program that has both great benefits but also a little bit of teeth to it.
Yep, exactly. Well, and I think the added advantage of being self-insured where you can actually get your own claims data
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a community-rated plan that may have, generally you don't even get the data if that's the case on a fully insured basis. But if you can see where you're at, and certainly if you're paying the claims yourself, you can have a much, much larger impact. But as Chris said earlier, I have encountered some insurance companies out there that are willing to work with employers that are trying to do things to aggressively manage their plan costs.
So you could get the plan information and the cost information from your health plan and work with them to design something with, you know, assistance from somebody like yourself to design a program that could be effective for that population. Yeah.
Absolutely true. If you show them a plan, I mean, certainly I think their underwriters are more than willing to consider that when they go through their rating cycle.
Did you have any privacy issues when you were going through the health screening process?
Well, certainly the data itself was managed by an independent outfit, and they, in fact, produced all of the aggregate results.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I, as the benefits manager and the privacy officer at the company, got information that the rest of the folks didn't see. I thought we might have a little bit of resistance because we were putting all of the at-risk folks in a classroom during the day, company time. Everyone kind of saw them going in. We really didn't get any pushback at all. At one point, we had one individual that was a little uncomfortable with the rest of the population knowing that he was going into these at-risk classes,
mm-hmm.
and we simply moved him to another location, and it became a non-issue.
Mm.
So while I think there may be potential for it, I would caution employers, don't borrow trouble because it may not be there.
Right. We'll talk to John a little bit, too, about what are some of the details and the guidelines for that kind of stuff. But clearly there's a solution. If you want to implement it, you can find a way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what are the costs to you of implementing a program like this? Were the costs that you saved incorporated over and above the cost that you spent for this program? When you say 34% were saved, was that just in healthcare costs? What kind of cost did it cost you to implement this program?
Well, this program isn't cheap, I'll guarantee that. However, maybe I should, at this point, the adage, you get what you pay for kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The screenings themselves, because we had them done on-site at each location, it ranged everywhere from a couple of plants that were able to have free resources come in to do the blood draws and biometric measurements.
Huh.
We had others that, one of them, in fact, it was out of this world. It was like $115 per person for the screening.
Wow.
And everything in between. Generally, somewhere between $35 and $50 you can probably get the screenings for. There are some organizations I've worked with that run those through their health plan as part of their wellness benefit that's built into the plan anyway.
Hmm.
So that's one way to help mitigate some of that. And then the dietitian that you bring in for the classes and the educational materials themselves, I would suggest that it's going to be anywhere in the neighborhood, depending on what region of the country you're in, between $500 and $1,200 per employee per year.
Per year. Okay. So when you take into account that kind of cost, now that was for your level of intensive program. There's clearly options to kind of carve back on the intensity of the program and still be effective.
Mm-hmm.
Would you assess that $500 to $1,200 per employee per year what kind of savings do you think you ended up with after expending that kind of money?
Well, I mean, if you look at just the raw numbers, you know, when we were clipping along anywhere between 12% and 14%, down to 2%, corporate wide, of course, at places like Cartersville, it was significantly higher.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at, you know, an overall savings of 10%.
Oh wow, that's still pretty significant.
You betcha.
So
sometimes, but I'm with Chris on the whole return on investment thing,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know how to measure what's not going to happen.
Right, right. So yeah, your soft costs are a little bit more difficult to measure, but you had some real hard costs there that you can say this is what we spent last year and this is what we spent this year.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful.
Exactly. And that doesn't even take into consideration things like disability that totally, I don't know why we were really targeting that, but it was one of those wonderful byproducts that as a result of people being healthier, feeling better, coming to work, being more productive, our disability costs decreased by 60%.
Wow.
So that's that's a whole other thing we didn't even measure into the equation. And then there's the elusive presenteeism, not to mention just the folks being more productive and feeling better and having great attitudes.
Now, is this a program that you all maintained over time to continue to encourage and maintain that level of health and decreased in costs?
Yes, and because I still am in touch with some of the folks, it continues to this day. And again, it continues its success. The number of folks at risk deteriorates, year after year. In fact, I think in Cartersville there's only a handful left. And you're going to have folks that need to be medically managed.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to be able to cure them all. But certainly you're going to get the majority of folks out of harm's way, and then you are left with folks that, as long as they're managed appropriately, it's just like a diabetic. To treat and manage a diabetic is not an outrageous amount of claims cost. But as soon as that diabetic is out of control, and that was the biggest claims we had year after year, were non-compliant diabetics.
Yeah.
When you run into, amputations and heart attacks and, all the things that go with that.
Yeah. I used to manage a diabetes disease management program for a disease management company in Raleigh, and I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
This is just wonderful information, Terry, and I know that our listeners here in Atlanta are really, I think, probably overwhelmed and awed by the fact that this kind of program can have this impact in that population base of only 200 to 300, which is what our target listeners are, is the small to mid-sized company. And I think in Atlanta, I know Chris has the statistics on this, that our median employer size is about 130 to 150 employer size. So this is exactly what our listeners needed to know, that there is a way that they can implement something beyond just shopping around for premium costs that can really have a dramatic impact on their costs, as well as their soft costs like presenteeism, productivity, and then some of the disability and stuff like that. That's just an incredible way to help save costs as well as increase productivity. Does anybody have any questions for Terry? No? Okay. Great. Well, I want to move to John Myers. John Myers is a partner in the law firm of Seyfarth Shaw, and he is concentrating his practice in labor and employment law on behalf of the employer management. Since 1983, he has represented private and public employers in all aspects of labor and employment law and litigation, including class action litigation, National Labor Relations Board matters, labor arbitrations, unfair competition, enforcement of covenants not to compete, employment discrimination, and wrongful discharge. Mr. Myers has litigated and tried various employment law disputes involving tort, contract, and statutory claims by employees. He also advises clients extensively in all aspects of human resources, including employee discipline, layoffs, wage and hour, employee handbooks, drug testing, workers' comp, and disability matters. Mr. Myers is labor and employment counsel to a wide range of client companies all over the country, and he is a frequent author and speaker on these topics. John, welcome to our show, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And what I wanted to do is, we've talked a little bit about the employer in Michigan, WICO, who totally banned employees smoking on-site, off-site, your personal life, whatever. And there are some articles out there that say that the Georgia laws that lack discrimination prohibition in this personal habit area, we could do that here in Georgia. Now, we've talked a lot about the program that Terry's company, TI Automotive, implemented that had a distinction and a different type of health plan benefit depending upon whether you did or did not participate in wellness programs. Can you tell us a little bit about where the boundaries are in terms of, if an employer here wanted to implement something as extreme as WICO did, which is banning all employees, how could they go about doing that, or could they do that? Could they start asking questions in interviews about, are you a smoker, what's your BMI, et cetera, et cetera? Where are the boundaries here in Georgia?
Okay, that's a great question, Don. Thank you. The problem with these smoking ban issues in Georgia, as in about 19 other states that haven't prohibited what's called lifestyle discrimination, is one of backlash. In other words, if you were to just simply tomorrow say we will no longer hire smokers, and if anybody is not quit smoking by the end of the week, they will be terminated. We're going to engage in what's called nicotine, urine-based nicotine testing, and terminate anybody that's found with trace levels of nicotine in their urine. You're going to face quite a backlash. So although technically it's legal, I think there would certainly be some claims under the rubric of some sort of discrimination that it was really my race or whatever. But the moral and HR issues, I think, would mount, and you would end up hurting yourself from a practical standpoint with such an autocratic sort of immediate, we're just going to ban smoking. And that's what happened with you keep mentioning WICO, and there's actually the Scott's Miracle-Gro case. They won challenges in states like Michigan and even Massachusetts, which most people think is fairly liberal. But the backlash was that all of these states began enacting lifestyle discrimination laws so that if you discriminate against somebody for practices or things that they do that aren't illegal but are performed off-duty, then you've violated their legal rights and are subject to damages. So from a practical standpoint, I think banning smoking is a very difficult thing. But if you were to do it, the practical things you would need to do, I think, is smoking cessation programs, a statute of limitations or a sunset provision by when people would be expected to quit smoking to sort of lessen this dramatic, I think, and brutal backlash that a company would face in sort of banning the employment of smokers. It's one thing to ban it in a facility, and Georgia has very strict no smoking laws and where you can smoke, and we all see them outside as a result, outside in the street. But it's another thing, I think, to just ban it outright.
Could you start asking, like, if you wanted to, carve out or at least be more careful about who you employed so as to not have to deal with the firing later and controlling of the calls, can you ask questions in an interview about somebody's personal habits like that?
Certainly the smoking question you can in Georgia. Again, we don't have a lifestyle discrimination law, so you could ask those questions, and I think what you'd get are just people lying on their applications. But you could try.
I know that the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, has some provisions there that prevent some kind of discrimination and require employers to make some kind of accommodation. When you're dealing with people like what Terry was talking about in her population base of diabetes, heart disease, obesity, high BMIs, where's the line there with some of those that kind of cross the border of disabilities and personal behavior, personal habits that you can try to weed out in an employee hiring process?
Yeah, I mean, in the hiring process, the ADA quite literally prohibits you from disadvantaging an employee or applicant, arguably because of their medical condition. So the problem in weeding out people based on their BMI or based on whether they have heart disease at the application stage is you're going to run afoul of the provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was amended at the end of 2008, at the end of George Bush's term, and requires that companies not engage in these sort of medical testing to make employment decisions of yes or no based on folks' medical conditions. So you do not want to ask that of job applicants.
So you can ask, do you smoke, but you can't ask, what's your weight or what's your, BMI, or do you have heart disease, or do you have any condition?
That's right. And the reason is that addiction to nicotine has never been treated as a disability under the ADA. And even the new interpretations or regulations, which are forthcoming from the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, I don't see that as an issue when it comes to smoking versus these other more some of these cross into GINA as well, the Genetic Information Discrimination Act, Non-Discrimination Act, I should say. So you got to be very careful there when you start asking people for their medical histories and medical conditions, because you're going to have these GINA prohibitions as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, we heard from Terry that her company implemented a different health program or a different plan that had different economic value. One was a $250 deductible, the other was a $1,000 deductible. And that's a pretty significant difference in health plans. I know with the recent health legislation that's been passed, there is some kind of prohibition on discriminating in your health plans for different employee populations. I don't know the details, but under the new plan, would something like that still be permissible?
Yeah, it should be. Here's the rule. HIPAA, this Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996, specifically contains a limit on how much of a reward you can offer employees for their participation in these wellness programs. And the reward cannot exceed 20% of the cost of employee-only coverage, which would be the total amount of the employee share of the premium and the employer share of the premium. And it cannot exceed 20% of that. So to take Terry's case of $750, given what certainly Chris has told us about what a premium can cost a year to cover one employee, $400 a month was a number I hear. I would think that if you added over 12 months, would be an acceptable reward for coming within this and would come within this 20% restriction. And by the way, under the new health care law that was signed, as we all know, this year, there'll be a lot of regulations, but we think that 20% will increase to 50% as this new law really encourages the type of wellness programs and preventative care that it's designed to. And I was talking to somebody earlier this morning. The focus of the new healthcare law on preventative medicine falls right into what Terry has been advocating and what Chris has been advocating, and that is things like colonoscopies. Companies are going to be required, or health insurance plans are going to be required to pay for that. And as everyone knows, just catching that type of cancer early rather than later is the difference between life and death, and certainly the difference between spending X amount of dollars to treat it through a very surgical removal or whatever to, you know, what can be a 6-7 month history of surgery and an uncertain outcome, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. That's great to know that we can continue to offer these distinctions in benefits based on the wellness program. I guess the wellness programs is an exception to the discriminatory provisions in HIPAA and the new legislation. Is that right?
That's right. They were specifically carved out of these rules, and they're all a little different. Let me just give you an example. Under the new Americans with Disabilities Act, there's an exemption for wellness programs. Typically, the ADA would almost eliminate, unless you're a firefighter, a police officer, one of these sort of life and death jobs, eliminates all medical exams and inquiries that occur in the workplace. So you can't mandate that people take medical exams, can't mandate that they answer very detailed inquiries into their health. But if you have a wellness program adopted by your health plan and it's truly voluntary, and you can use these sort of rewards to make sure that it's a little more involuntary, but as Terry pointed out, she's still at 10% of the people who are willing to pay $1,000 and just live with it.
Mm-hmm.
The EEOC allows in its guidelines these voluntary participation programs as exceptions to the ADA. So that's an issue. Under HIPAA, which is certainly deals with this, I think, the most broadly, it lays out the tests and the rules that are very, very technical that apply to these wellness programs. But the law prohibits any discrimination against an employee based on their health condition when determining benefits or premiums. But it exempts wellness programs that follow the following guidelines. And we talked about the 20% rule. The next guideline is that it has to be a voluntary participation, again, subject to using the 20% carrot and stick. And it gives some really good examples of things that that would qualify as voluntary as opposed to involuntary. For example, you can pay for fitness centers. You can encourage people to undergo preventative care. You can pay an employee if they take diagnostic tests. And you can issue reward cards. I think Chris said $100 is a pretty good amount for people who attend and complete, say, a series of health education classes with the type of dietitians and the other things that Terry so spoke on. So those are examples of things that work. You also have really technical rules. You have to give an opportunity annually for employees to qualify to participate in this reward program. And if you have somebody who's truly sick, you have to come up with what are called reasonably alternative programs that would apply to people who medically can't participate in a normal wellness program. They can't join the walking club. They can't go to a fitness center. And this is a little technical, but you would have to have some kind of reasonable alternatives. And you also have to have literature that discloses these issues to your employees. And more or less, like anything else under a benefit plan, it would constitute like a summary plan description of your wellness program.
So, like, for example, when you say that they're medically unable to participate, a real-life example would be somebody who's so obese that if part of a wellness program was to exercise or to walk, you know, around, you know, a certain area during lunch, this person may not be able to do that because it could actually cause, you know, additional heart problems or whatever because they weren't capable of doing that. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
That's right. And I would think a reasonable alternative might be like a stationary bike for that person,
mm-hmm.
and allow them to participate in a program that had stationary bikes as opposed to, you know, real life walking, which, as we all know, is more arduous.
Who is the entity that kind of decides if the person is being compliant or not?
The plan administrator. You want to do this pursuant to the rules of ERISA. So you have a health plan. All companies are required to have a plan administrator, which would be
so usually somebody from the company is deciding whether that employee is actually compliant enough so that they can get the discount and benefits.
That's right, Lee.
I would say in some situations that we work on with our clients, we use a third party, and they would tell the employer if the person qualified or didn't qualify.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason we tend to do it that way is some of the HIPAA privacy issues that might come up if that particular person's information is known and shared inside the workplace, where we have an independent third party make that determination, and then they just tell the employer pass or fail or qualify or don't qualify. Mm-hmm. So we don't know why they qualified. It could have been a medical exemption. Mm-hmm. It could have been a doctor's note saying this person's too sick to participate in this program. You need to. And then if they get something like that, you have to allow them to qualify by default.
Yeah, I've read something that the employer can actually require a real certification that says this person cannot participate. Whether that's, I guess, by a doctor or when you say a third party, Chris, are you looking at wellness programs?
Yeah, I was talking about two different things. One would be that a doctor would have to provide the certification,
mm-hmm.
but a third party, a wellness vendor, mm-hmm. if you will, would actually do the measurement and do the analysis on whether someone passed or didn't pass, and then they would just report back, here's the list of people that qualify for the incentive.
Right. Now, and those wellness programs typically are offered through the health insurer, or are they offered as an extra retention by the employer?
It's a good question, and there's a lot of both. A few years back, I think the market sort of developed before the health insurance carriers caught on that this was where the market was going. So that's why the independent wellness vendors sprung up and became so prevalent and popular. In the last couple of years, maybe three or four, if you look harder in different parts of the country, the traditional health insurance carriers have further developed their programs. And that's actually a big part of our consulting with our clients, is helping them decide, should we use what's with our carrier already, or should we go out and seek a third party to do this for us? And the really kind of the pros and cons there, the biggest is people don't tend to stay with their health insurance carrier forever. You know, if they get a really bad renewal one year, they may be forced to shop and move to a different carrier. Well, if they had all their wellness eggs, so to speak, in one basket with that carrier, once they change, they would have to effectively start their wellness program all over again.
That's a good point. You know, John, we were talking about the lawsuits that arose as a result of WICO implementing this no smoking policy comprehensively. And although they won, it did create this backlash, as you mentioned, with all these laws being passed in other states. Have you seen another example that has proven to be problematic for employers in implementing some kind of activity like this to try to control costs?
Yeah, I mean, I use the example of Scott's Miracle-Gro. Most companies, I think, or at least the ones that are in reported cases, Don, I have not seen a company that has said, we're not going to hire anybody with a BMI index over 30. They would use someone like Terry to address how to get it down to 25 mm-hmm. and reward, again, the participation, not the actual move down the BMI scale. So I just haven't seen that yet. But where I have seen the litigation is in these no smoking bans. And although the employers have won, it was not, I think, without great cost to all of us, as the state legislatures, all 31 of them, have gotten busy to pass these lifestyle discrimination statutes, even beyond North Carolina, which has done the most it can to protect its tobacco industry. Even I think they are backing away now from some of the protections that they've given people who want to use tobacco in the state where it is founded and still such an important industry around Winston-Salem, as you know, and Durham.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had mentioned Terry mentioned labor unions, and I know your background, John, is extensive in this area. Can you implement the same kind of just different policies inside a labor environment? I know we're not big on labor unions down here in the Georgia area, but I know that there are some around there. What can we do in the labor force?
I actually had this exact issue this year. A company implemented a kind of a wellness program. It was to bring people back to work, what are called work hardening programs, so that they could do light duty work until they were cleared to return to their normal job on the waterfront in the stevedoring field, which it's ripe with injuries and is a lot of heavy lifting. And what happened was the company implemented this program without bargaining with the union first. And this is just simply a step that a union employer would have to take in implementing a wellness program, is you would have to meet with a union. You don't have to get their agreement, but you have to bargain to impasse. So you'd have two or three meetings and get their either stamp of approval on it or not. And for a lot of companies that have contracts that last a year or 2 years, they would need to really focus on the bargaining over the new contract and make sure that this was part of the bargaining process and part of their agenda, along with, you know, reducing healthcare costs, reducing wages, increasing productivity. The addition of a wellness program has to be bargained impasse with a union before it can, or you run afoul of the National Labor Relations Act.
Hmm. So have you been seeing an increase in employee lawsuits or claims with the labor boards as a result of some of these cost-cutting activities going on in the employers lately?
Yeah, I think it's like a lot of answers we heard today, which were all good. There's just so many factors involved. I think in general, our society is becoming far more litigious. There's so many more hooks. There's so many lawyers graduating that have to feed their families by bringing these claims, that I certainly think any push by a company to change the rules can result in employee dissatisfaction, which can result into the dreaded trip to a plaintiff's lawyer or to a union in various parts of the country, maybe not here in Atlanta yet. So, yes, I would say it plays a role. I wanted to just get into one other area too, Dawn, if I could.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the privacy area. It's been mentioned a couple times.
Yep.
People have, in various states, there's a constitutional right to privacy, a statutory right to privacy. But in all states, including Georgia, there's a common law right to privacy. And that is a right to be free from intrusions on our seclusion, our individual space. And one of the things that can happen with these very invasive programs, that could, if you go to the extreme, can be people would say my rights to privacy have been violated. And have we seen a lot of these claims yet? No. But that would be one thing to watch out for, is to get the right advice from professionals like Chris and Terry, so that the program is designed professionally. People are notified and informed of what's going to happen. They're given time to adjust, so it's not just pounced on with poor communication. Because I think people, as they flock out to lawyers, this right to privacy is going to be something that is discussed. And we do see privacy claims brought all the time in the context of what should be sexual harassment claims. But everyone likes to stay in state court, and a right to privacy in Alabama, for example, which is just, I think it's 120 miles from where we are now, they're very vague descriptions of the case law. And if you can sue your supervisor and you can sue the company, there's no way the company can remove the case to federal court, and it's very unlikely the state court judge is going to throw it out without a jury trial, which is why plaintiff's lawyers love to bring these things in state court, and the right to privacy is another one of their hooks.
That's very good information to know. And like what Terry was saying, that the success of her programs and the different sites were directly related to the management support and the way management handled and implemented the program. So that clearly is a major impact on the success of a program, not only in terms of the employee-based health and the costs, but also avoiding disgruntled employees and potential litigation. So that's great information. Well, it sounds like what we really need to do with these employers is put together the three of you for great consultation between Terry helping to design the program and Chris helping to go out and shop it around with some of the health insurers if you're fully insured, and then John, make sure we cover with you to make sure we're doing the right thing. So John, tell us a little bit more about your firm and your practice and what your sweet spot is in terms of how you can help folks best and how to reach you.
Sure. Our firm is a national footprint. We have 9 offices, so we're in every region. We have over 720 lawyers. But I think what makes our firm unique is half of those lawyers, you know, roughly 360 or so, are either employee benefits lawyers or they're employment labor lawyers like I am. So we cover everything from counseling to wage hour litigation to employee benefits compliance to training to immigration to EEOC litigation, EEOC defense, the whole gamut of anything that would face an employer. And I can be reached at 404-888-1888. And our website is www.seyfarth, spelled SEYFARTH.com. And I'm Jay Myers, 2 E's, MEYERS, at seyfarth.com.
Okay, wonderful. Now, did anybody have any additional legal questions for John?
I was going to ask one. I mentioned during my section that some of my clients are considering requiring employees to agree to participate in a wellness program before they're allowed to sign up for health insurance. Do you believe under current law that would be allowable?
I think your problem is going to be the ADA and the EEOC are requiring it be that it be voluntary. So requiring it before they're eligible for health insurance, it could be a problem. It's certainly something I'd want to scrub out. It's a gray area, but I think your problems are going to be under the ADA.
And so their fallback would be the current limit of 20% of premium as an incentive, that, and with that possibly increasing in the future.
Correct.
All right, great.
Wonderful. And Terry, it sounds like you have had some of the greatest success of anybody in implementing wellness programs that are both successful in controlling costs as well as being accepted by the employee base. Tell us a little bit more about your company, what you're trying to accomplish with your target customers and how we can reach you.
The company is Impact Corporate Health Solutions, and the target companies are small to medium-sized employers, but truly we could do the same type of thing with larger ones. It's just a matter of scalability. And our solutions that we offer are primarily really out-of-the-box thinking. And this is not, and I recognize, a traditional wellness plan, but if it's well-planned, and I think your point earlier of communicating this and getting employee acceptance, this needs to be planned well in advance. This isn't something you want to drop on employees during open enrollment meetings, unless it's for the following year, so you give them plenty of time to adjust and ask questions and that type of thing. And so we help them develop that communication program, educate them on what's included in claim costs and those types of things, what it looks like and why this is important. We also educate them on chronic disease and what all that means and how they're at risk. Just because it doesn't hurt doesn't mean it's not there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, facilitating and coordinating the screenings, the dietitian, the program material, that type of thing, as well as the follow-up. I mean, we truly become an arm of the HR department or the benefits department, if you will, to try and take the burden off of them because they got plenty to do as it is.
Yeah. And how do we reach you?
Well, a couple ways. My email address is tforman.chs@gmail.com. And my phone number is area code 586-201-4302.
And you practice all over the country, so even though you're no longer located in the Atlanta area, you still work with Atlanta companies?
Absolutely, yep.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I want to thank all of our three guests, Terry Foreman, John Myers, and Chris Clark, for participating in our show today that told us so much about what's available to employers now with controlling costs, but also, as Terry pointed out, preventing costs for those people with high risk that you don't even know about yet. And that's very critical, and especially if companies can implement something to produce a 34% discount in premiums with only a 2% increase or 34% discount in healthcare costs, but a 2% decrease in premiums. That's a significant savings for employers that are struggling right now with all of their costs, and that it can be effective. So I encourage our listeners to contact Terry, Chris, and John to implement something that could be greatly beneficial to them. Thank you again for joining us. Lee, who is our sponsor again?
Palladium CLO brings to your business in-depth knowledge of your industry, of the players in your industry, their businesses, and how the various legal and business issues affect your industry and your business. Palladium sees the possibilities, not just the liabilities. You can find out more at www.palladiumclos.com.
Wonderful. Well, our show next week is going to be on franchising and whether or not your business is suitable for franchising and what are the benefits and issues involved in that. So I hope you'll join us next week. And until then, thank you again for joining us on Corporate Conversations.